Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go. Oh, yes, to very the true. Lobby.
It is time for Pass the Popcorn as we welcome in Alan Adams of The Main Edge. Hello, Al.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Happy Monday to you.
And to you as well.
Good to have you here with us. I was feeling kind of lonely here in the studio all by myself.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's one of those things where you just look around and it's like you're just used to there being more people in here.
Right, right. Kerry, under the weather, he's battling some stuff, but... he'll be fine. He'll be fine.
Sure, sure.
I told him I've put dibs in on his office.
Well, of course.
It takes a turn for the worse, but otherwise he'll be back, we hope, later this week.
For sure, for sure.
How was your weekend?
It was good. It was good. You know, did some around the house stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Actually finished putting up my Christmas lights today.
Oh, now I drove by your house.
Yeah.
I'm not stalking you, but I drove by your house, the tree. From the outside, looked fabulous.
Yep. It's actually funny. We trimmed the tree fully last night. We had put the lights on a little bit earlier, but we did all the ornaments and stuff last night while we watched the Grey Cup. Like that was how.
What a heck of a game that!
Yeah,
was,
wasn't
too.
It good, man? Like
I was in and out. I didn't watch the whole thing.
Oh, sure. Yeah,
but.
Yeah. But you know, and it's like and. Man, I do love that CFL overtime, man.
That's the way to do it.
The sort of offensive shootout mini game kind of vibe to it. Like it's really fun, it almost ensures that it basically sets you up for an exciting ending, which is really it's really what you want. So I sat there with my had poutine for dinner. big can of moose head.
Oh,
like
man.
really just did it up.
And your team won, or at least the team you picked.
The team I picked won. I was early on there, I was like, oh yeah, my apologies, Winnipeg, but they got it done. And I mean, it makes sense. Like they were the best team this year. So the year end awards. Zach Collaros, the Bombers QB, won MOP. Most outstanding defensive player was Adam Big Hill, who's a linebacker also for the Bombers. So, it's just a really, they had the best record, scored the most points, gave up the least. Like, that's how it's supposed to work out.
Yeah, there you go. All right, well, let's talk movies. You saw three, but you only told us about two.
Yeah, there's, I saw, there's a movie called Encounter. It's currently streaming on Amazon. It had a brief theatrical release last week, and then went to streaming this week. Stars Riz Ahmed, who's very talented, but we don't need to talk about this movie. Like it's just one of those things where I didn't particularly enjoy myself. It's one of those movies that starts fairly strong, but then falls apart pretty thoroughly in the back half. Builds itself as sort of a paranoid thriller, but doesn't really deliver in the way that I was kind of hoping it would. So Encounter, I didn't care for it, but I don't know, maybe you folks out there will.
All right, well, two other films that you saw garnering a lot more attention.
Yes.
Where should we begin?
Let's start with Being the Ricardos, because frankly the other one I think we're gonna I really want to talk spend some time on, but I got to say, Being the Ricardos, and this is going to be a theme that carries forward to the next film as well. I wasn't sure about this one. The players involved, I love Aaron Sorkin.
Me too.
I know some people don't care for what he brings to the table, but I am a fan. Like, I'm in the bag for Aaron Sorkin. Written and directed by, I don't think he's as strong a director as he is a writer. I will say this movie, he's getting closer, because the direction of this movie is very good. I was one of the people who had the same sort of questions that much of the internet did when it was announced that Nicole Kidman, would be cast as Lucille Ball. I didn't necessarily get it. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I was far from alone in that.
I thought the same thing.
But I tell you what, man, it works. I mean, she doesn't really look like Lucille Ball. They do some prosthetic stuff and try to, bridge the gap a little bit. But one of the things that I wasn't prepared for with this movie was the fact that it didn't ask her to be the Lucille Ball that we see on television. Like, they didn't ask her to try to recreate that sort of slapstick magic that Lucille Ball brought to the screen, which is good because nobody else can do that.
Right, right.
You know, like, I don't care if you find someone, like there are some gifted physical comedians out there, but like Lucy did it first and Lucy did it best. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's like, so Sorkin put Kidman in a position to succeed by not forcing her down those roads. And we see little snippets in places, but the conceit of the film is it's a slice of life biopic instead of a cradle to grave, which is very much my preference, particularly when you're dealing with someone like this.
Right.
And it's basically set over the course of a week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. I knew it was a small window.
Yep. Table read to taping, but it's during the stretch where word had just come out that at one point in her life Lucille Ball was a member of the Communist Party.
Oh, I did not know that. Wow.
And it's explained in the movie, but basically it's like her dad was a big union guy, in the 30s. I'm sorry, her grandfather. In the 30s, and you know, the mid 30s, like communists weren't scary like
right,
they were
right.
in the 50s,
yes,
which is when this movie takes place. And so, you know, she went in front of HUAC and was cleared by the committee and all that stuff. But this other little bit of news sort of starts to bubble up, and there's all this panic around the show because it's like, well, if she gets painted with like as a communist, like the sponsor, Philip Morris, which basically bankrolled the show. The executives at CBS, like everybody's going to abandon ship, which that's another great thing about this movie. Like, I'm going to jump around a little bit, but it also, there's a very nice sort of inside baseball kind of vibe to it with regard to like how the sausage was made back in the 1950s, because, you know, television was a nascent industry. Mm. Like no one really knew what it was going to become.
Well, I think he gets credit a bit more now, but nobody realized at the time all the things that Desi Arnaz was doing behind the scenes and what an innovator he was.
Well, and that's something that comes up in this film as well. Desi played brilliantly by Javier Bardem. Mm. He is exceptional in this movie. But that's one of the things that sort of gets addressed is, you know, the idea of he essentially invented the multicam sitcom.
Right.
You know, and structured it in such a way so that studio audiences could actually watch what was happening. And it seems so it just seems so natural now, but
and invented the rerun.
Yeah. You know what I mean? And it's just just this brilliant, you know, leaving aside, he was a brilliant songwriter and singer and just an incredibly talented guy. But so you've got this communist thing, sort of percolating. There's a story out about Desi potentially being unfaithful to Lucy, and all of it, again, is condensed in this sort of week-long period, but Sorkin does something very clever here, and he basically frames the film inside a sort of faux documentary. And so you've got older versions of the people that we meet. We spend a lot of time in the writer's room, and so older versions of those characters are sort of talking heads in this sort of documentary thing. So it opens up the possibilities to so we get to see when they met and, you know, all these other sort of bits and pieces from their history, without sort of losing that singular sort of 1 week kind of thread. It's a really smart way to do it, I think, because I think you need a little bit of context, when you're telling a story like this. It's like, you and I are very familiar with who Lucille Ball is, but, you know, as someone who's 25 years old, like, how much do they know about?
Well, and those writers, too. I mean, people like Bob Carroll and Marilyn Pugh, Bill Asher, who went on to produce and write Bewitched. I mean, just a really talented group of people in that room.
Yeah, and we do have, we do spend time with Carroll and Pugh, played by Jake Lacy and Alia Shawkat, respectively.
Oh, nice.
They're both very good. Tony Hale plays Jess Oppenheimer.
Oh, love it.
You know, it's so good. And, you know, and then we get the older versions of them are played by John Rubenstein, Ronnie Cox.
Wow.
Linda Lavin.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Maine native.
Right. So it's just like all this wonderful stuff kind of tied together. You know, and it's like even like the two scene, like, you know, executive parts are people you recognize, like, you know, people like Clark Gregg just pop up for Sorkin favorites showing up for a scene or two just because, you know, he loves to work with them or whatever.
And how was J.R. Simmons?
Oh, J.K. Simmons. Oh, man.
J.K. Simmons.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I didn't even get to his William Frawley might be my favorite part of this entire movie. So good. And it's just like from the second he hits the screen, you're like, OK, so, the, you know, you just nailed, you know, and the woman playing Vivian Vance, whose name escapes me right now, but she's also wonderful. And so we get some of that sort of dynamic as well, like the issues that sort of sprung up, professional and otherwise, amidst the cast and all. It's all just wonderfully complicated, and this beautiful sort of microcosm of what it meant to make TV back then, while also sort of exploring the business side of things in a way that I don't think people really consider when they think about that time in television history. And and they're just like all these wonderful filmmaking touches that really work. First of all, Sorkin dialogue and a story about Lucille Ball is a perfect match. Like, that sort of snappy patter really, really clicks. There's a wonderful device that he uses, where a few times over the course of, over the film, we see like one of the classic, like, I Love Lucy bits, like, pitched to Lucy, and we get to watch, and he does this wonderful thing where he fades to black and white, and he basically has her imagine the bits as they're being pitched to her. And so we get to see little snippets of recreation of those iconic moments.
Nice.
Yeah. So like the grape stomping one is the one that really stands out. Cause we get to see her sort of work that out, like, in her head. Like, is this funny? Like, how is this funny? In what ways will we make this funnier? And it's just really smart filmmaking. And like I said, Kidman's very good. Bardem's great. Simmons is phenomenal. But I mean, just the cast across the board is really good. But again, I think that's par for the course with Sorkin. Mm-hmm. Like, I think people really like working with him, certainly with his scripts, and he's really coming into his own as a director. So I'll be very curious to see what happens with this movie going forward, because it's got some really iconic performances, and it's the sort of thing where, you know, I think there are a couple of people in this cast that the Academy was going to want to recognize.
Interesting. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that. And of course, looking forward to seeing the other film you're going to talk about, which has been a bit of a disappointment at the box office. But I think there are all kinds of reasons for that. But tell us about the remake of West Side Story.
Again, as I sort of said about being the Ricardos, I had some doubts about this one because West Side Story. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, it's, the 1961 film, based on the 1957 musical, but like Jerome Robbins, man, like Jerome Robbins doing his thing with what would become, frankly, one of the most acclaimed films in Hollywood history. Like, this movie won 10 Oscars, man.
Right.
Like, this is not some sort of under-celebrated piece of Hollywood history. Like, this is one of the big ones. And so there's a part of me that's like, I mean, like, do you really do that? Like, do you really go, try to redo something that is so universally beloved? As it turns out, Steven Spielberg and Tony Kushner, real good at making movies.
They know some things.
Like,
yeah.
Really good. Mm. Rich, this movie's phenomenal. Like, it's just outstanding, like, across the board. It is so, so good. And I'm someone, like, I was never a huge West Side Story guy. I've seen the movie a few times. And I mean, the songs are all-timers, you know what I mean? But the movie itself, like, it's like, I recognized it for its importance, but it didn't always resonate with me.
Sure.
But this one, man, I tell you, like, it is just so, so wonderful. Like, from the word go, like, you are just dropped into, it's filmed on location. Like, it is in New York City, and it doesn't have that sort of you know, that sort of backlot kind of vibe that you get right. with movies of the, you know, the previous films, you know, era. I'm not going to go into the plot synopsis of West Side Story.
Like, apparently it has something to do with Shakespeare.
Yeah. You know, it's like, you want to know what West Side Story is about, read Romeo and Juliet. You'll be fine. That basically will pick it up for you. But we just got, I mean, I just want to talk about, first of all, Spielberg, who apparently is a passionate fan of musicals, like loves
really
musicals. I had no idea.
I didn't either.
You know, and this is his first one. Like, yeah. He's never made one before. And so, like ever since he was a kid, apparently, like, he's been in love with this story, with this show. And, you know, the fact that it's like, okay, like, one of the greatest, you know, I say one of, probably the greatest, like, mainstream filmmaker of the last 50 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean? Decides, oh, I'm going to take on this, you know, this... you know, universally beloved and populist sort of musical. Who can I get to update the book for me? Hey, Tony, what are you up to these days? You know, and it's Kushner does a wonderful job of walking the line between being respectful of the original. Like, there's a reverence here that is inescapable, and I think deserved. I think it belongs there. You should be respectful of this. But at the same time, like, he finds ways to put his own stamp on it and to sort of, like, he gives it a little bit more edge, a little bit more grit. And, I alluded to it in my review, but our friend Eric Grattan referenced it on Twitter. The idea of being able to make a fight scene that is both feels dangerous and menacing and involves ballet. Is a stunning accomplishment, and you get that here.
Wow.
Like, the rumble scene in this movie is outstanding, but, like, all the production numbers are outstanding. Like, I love a good production number. Like I am ready to suspend my disbelief. Like, I am ready to believe that these street gangs in mid-50s New York City are gonna sing and dance their way up and down the street. I am ready to believe that, but you have to execute to keep me.
Right.
And that's the thing. The execution is exquisite across the board. Like, every single scene is beautifully realized. Like, nobody does spectacle and bombast like Spielberg, and that's what musicals are, especially this era of musical theater. Right. There's this wonderful sense. It just feels big, and it feels like cinematic, but it also feels intimate in the way that only, like, you know, only those sorts of connections can be. Everybody sings their own songs, which I wholeheartedly approve of.
Yeah.
So let's talk performances. One of my biggest concerns about this whole thing was Ansel Elgort.
Right.
Because I don't know that old Ansel brings a ton to the table, in terms of presence. Like, he's got a good voice. Like, he can move. Like, he's got a very wonderful sort of gracefulness to himself as a performer. But I just didn't know that he's a particularly good actor. He fits wonderfully here. Like, he's probably lowest tier as far as performances, but it's still really good.
He's Tony?
Yeah, he's Tony. The young woman playing Maria, Rachel Zegler is her name. First movie, she basically beat out, like, Spielberg. They put out a casting call on Twitter and were just like, right, we're looking for someone new. She beat out, like, something like 30,000 other hopefuls to land this part. And, got to say, we're going to be seeing a lot more of this young lady going forward. I know she's got a couple of things coming. She's going to be a Disney princess in one of the live action remakes that's coming. But we're going to see a lot from this young lady because she's very talented. But once you start, like, moving into the sort of supporting characters, the guy playing Riff, is this guy, Mike Feist, who I'd never seen before. Broadway guy, was Tony nominated for one of the supporting roles in Dear Evan Hansen.
Oh, okay.
Great song and dance guy. And just a wonderfully, like, magnetic presence. And, like, he's one of the first people you see. And so he's sort of our gateway into this world. And it's marvelous. The woman who plays Anita, I want to make sure I get the name right, because She is, yes, Ariana DeBose. Is
from Hamilton.
Yes. Maybe the best performance in the entire show.
Wow.
Like, I mean, she is just outstanding. Like, you know, and whether we're talking about her interactions with Bernardo or who's Bernardo's played by, what is his name? I want to make sure I get it right. David Alvarez. You know, and, you know, he's got the, you know, they've got a wonderful chemistry together. He's wonderful with Maria. You know, they've done some tweaks. Chino, is a much more important role in this film, than he is, in previous offerings. There's the role of, anybody's, which, has traditionally been played as sort of a tomboy girl, is played by a trans actor. Like it's never explicitly stated, but it is implied that this character is trans, and it's a really interesting, I think, smart kind of way, sort of to address some of the disparities, even within the ranks of the assorted gangs. Another choice that Spielberg makes that I think is really smart: he doesn't subtitle the Spanish.
Oh,
yeah, it's just like, and I'll tell you, I speak zero Spanish. I didn't have a problem.
No.
There are people who are going to express problems, but we'll just say that odds are they're not necessarily arguing in good faith with regard to their reaction to this. But yeah, just...
And he brought back Rita Moreno, for goodness sakes.
And you know what? And this is maybe the biggest alteration to the original. So they basically took the character of Doc, turned it into Valentina, who is essentially Doc's widow, and let Rita Moreno play that part. And she sings Somewhere, man. Ugh. And it's just like, I'm already kind of a wreck sitting there, and it's like, this starts and I'm like, well, yeah, thanks for nothing, Spielberg. Like, I gotta figure out how to pull my crap together. But you know, I mean, I've got like 20 minutes before the lights come up, and, you know, I gotta get out of here with my dignity intact. But it's so beautiful. Like all the songs, like, the production numbers, like Tonight and America, they're bangers. But I will tell you, man, Officer Krupke is a one. It's a hell of a number.
Oh, it's a great number.
It's a great number. Like, period. They do a great job with it here. You know, Officer Krupke, played by Brian D'Arcy James.
Oh, love it.
Right. With the lieutenant being played by Corey Stahl. Like, it's just all these familiar faces just popping up. Surrounded by this incredible collection of talent, just drawn from these various Broadway sort of productions, because again, it can't be stressed enough, like all these people can dance. Mm. They can dance, and when you have a movie like this that is so reliant on choreography, and again, they steered away from the Jerome Robbins choreography. There are sort of allusions to it here and there, but it is very much its own thing. Which again is a positive thing, although I didn't necessarily believe it would be going in. I had heard that, you know, they had sort of eschewed most of the Robbins sort of choreography, and you know, that's just what you know. So it's like, oh, but having the opportunity to kind of see it, you know, reimagined a little bit, I think is really wonderful. You know, the story still resonates today. There's a lot going on in West Side Story that is just as applicable to the way we live our lives today as it was back in the, you know, in the mid 50s. But yeah, it's remarkable because, you know, you don't expect a remake of a classic to itself have a chance to be a classic. But I think that's where we are.
Well, and I've heard people say it, and maybe blasphemy, but that this version might be better.
I mean, as in terms of like technical accomplishment, I mean, I think that's a fair statement. Like, I think just in terms of like sheer like blockbuster scale movie making, you know, that this idea of spectacle writ large, I mean, nobody does that better than Spielberg.
No.
I don't know that anyone has ever done that better than Spielberg. And for him to sort of turn that eye onto, this sort of stage musical, which again, you know, not to get too far into the weeds here, but it does sort of, you know, it's the inverse of the sort of Socratic pyramid of drama, where it's like, you know, it's, you know, in his eyes, a spectacle is at the bottom. But, you know, with the musical, that spectacle is very, very much on the surface. Like, that's what's most important. And to address that with someone like Spielberg, working from a script by someone like Tony Kushner, with a cast led by so many incredibly talented people, it's just like all the pieces clicked into place. I was absolutely blown away by West Side Story.
Now, it again, had a disappointing weekend at the box office. How much of that was or is the older audience that's familiar with the story still a little reluctant to go out to movie theaters?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think there's just a little. I think it boils down to the fact that everybody's just kind of tired, you know. And
and how much of it too is there's a segment of the population out there that really doesn't want to hear about people getting along and getting together and finding love and peace and brotherhood because they're mad and they want to fight.
Yes, you know, and this is not a movie, you know, despite being structured around basically an ongoing feud. It's not about that. It is very much about the nature of connection. It is about finding love, what that means, and what you're willing to do to sort of bring that love to light. And it's, look, I don't know why people didn't go see it. Like, I'm frankly a little mystified, if I'm going to be honest about it, because this is a movie, it'll be fine at home. But if you can see it on a big screen, I can't recommend it highly enough because it is just that sheer size, that scope. It's just a reminder of why we go to the movies in the first place.
Well, I can't wait to see it. Two good ones this week. Fantastic. Yeah. Thanks, Al.
My pleasure.
Alan Adams talking movies here on Pass the Popcorn.